In the extraordinary circumstances of the COVID-19 pandemic, TNI and its allies are working to continue to bring you radical analysis of the most pressing issues of the day. We bring together excellent experts to discuss how this pandemic health crisis exposes the injustices of the global economic order, and how this crisis must be a turning point towards creating the systems, structures, and policies that can always protect those who are marginalized and allow everyone to live with dignity. Welcome. My name is Sean Macheza with the Transnational Institute. The following is the key presentation made by Rob Wallace at a webinar on global food inequality and COVID-19. Rob Wallace is the author of Big Farms Make Big Flu and co-author of Neoliberal Ebola, Modeling Disease Emergence from Finance to Forest and Farm.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here in spite of our present circumstances. And I wanted to begin with the present status of the pandemic. The Johns Hopkins Global Map has us this morning at 2 million confirmed COVID cases worldwide and 128,000 dead. Given the count some countries are reporting as suspected cases, this confirmed caseload is likely 5 to 10 times an underestimate. So at worst, as many as 20 million people have to this point been infected, some worse than others. For the worse, with uneven testing across the globe and some areas stretched to medical capacity, deaths are also likely undercounted. More than a quarter of the confirmed cases are situated here in the United States, with large outbreaks in Europe and the Middle East. The Global South is already beginning its run up the epic curve in a context of comparatively lesser public health capacity, fewer household resources for sheltering in place, and a wider array of underlying comorbidities, that is, other health conditions that can complicate a COVID infection. Indeed, as occurred for the HIV epidemic in the most impoverished areas, both global north and south, other matters, including getting food on the table, may be more pressing than what many infected may gamble is only a passing shortness of breath. Now, that all said, COVID isn't merely business as usual. We see some telling reversals. Britain is accepting shipments of masks from Vietnam. Cuba sent doctors to NATO member Italy. And Senegal is turning around COVID tests in 4 hours, while in the U.S., such tests, even when available, are taking up to 10 days. These telltales are underway during what the world systems theorists describe as a major shift in the cycles of capital accumulation, which have structured much of the world order the past 500 years. And the present pandemic serves as a marker of such a shift, as a shockingly immediate precipice as well. So here we have the United States on the tail end of its cycle of capital accumulation, turning capital back to money for the wealthiest. That is, it's cashing out at this point. Outside its military budget, it's not really investing newly into the infrastructure of global empire. American power, for instance, was up until this outbreak on the hook for cleaning up pandemics that capital the world over had helped create. The U.S. tasked itself with keeping the global system on the same developmental path, despite the ultimately unsustainable and frankly hideous destruction to land and people that path represents. So defunding the World Health Organization, as the U.S. did yesterday, isn't an exercise in imperial might. It's a white flag. It's a capitulation to the American role up to this point. Domestically, the U.S. failures to respond to its own outbreak are more than missteps by the administration, and were programmed in decades ago as the shared commons of public health were simultaneously neglected and sold off. A country captured by the regimen of individualized just-in-time public health, which is an utter contradiction, is now presently barely having enough hospital beds and equipment for normal operations, is by definition unable to marshal the resources necessary to pursue the scale of disease suppression that a COVID outbreak demands. Indeed, many a New Yorker denied access to critical care beds and now gasping for breath on their couch at home has much more in common with a West African infected with Ebola in a structurally adjusted healthcare system than any other New Yorker wealthy enough to pay for medical care on demand. I mean, 2,000 New Yorkers were found dead in their homes the first 8 days this month. Rural areas here are also starting to get pummeled. Louisa County in Iowa, which is home to a Tyson Company meatpacking plant through which COVID burned right through, is hosting more cases of COVID per capita than New York State. The county, which is home to 11,000 people, has neither a hospital nor a practicing physician living there. And in other words, to visit, you're going to have to bring your copy of Where There Is No Doctor. China, in contrast, is on the front end of its cycle of accumulation. It is invested in building the infrastructure, including global public health. It needs to turn money into capital and imperial might. This isn't to absolve China of its public health ills, as we'll discuss further, but we should note that the structural impulse there is different. Indeed, upon an initial stumble, China moved to eradicate COVID from Hubei, the province of origin, by deploying 40,000 medical staff and conducting comprehensive contact tracing and testing. Now, beyond this contrast of two giants, the question is why some countries escape the worst of the outbreak. And that's worth commenting on. I mean, there's a matter of geography, how close to an epicenter. South America and Africa are starting up late this way, but even countries bordering China escape the worst of it. Now, it helps if a government both prepares the country during the advance warning it's been given and sees the shared commons as still part of the purview of governance. I mean, like, what a concept, right? Taiwan, for instance, tests people at the airport for COVID-19, disinfects their suitcases, drives each person separately to their destination in a government-provided taxi, and gives each arrival one phone app that tells them where in their area they're staying that they can purchase a mask, and another app, which is slightly creepy, that lists local infections and their case histories. Iceland aggressively tests its population and isolates the positive cases. It deploys detectives to trace any infection. Those in contact with a case are also sequestered, so that if any of these people prove to be infected, they're already in quarantine. The rest of the country goes about its business, walking free outside without masks. Vietnam provides comprehensive health care to nearly the entirety of its population, and unlike, say, Louisa County in Iowa, has doctors and nurses in every community. So along with the typical border protocols, like China, whole buildings are quarantined should a case be detected, but the building is also provided three meals a day. Apartment buildings host whole body sanitizing stations at all entrances. Empty hotels are used as quarantine sites where doctors make house calls. Everybody wears a mask. And unlike the US, where the federal government set off a black market bidding war for ventilators between its states, there are few, if any, reports out of Vietnam of price gouging, panic buying, or hoarding. Now, that all said, all countries are in for a rough ride with the global economy already falling toward a recession before the outbreak began. Disease and deficits are interacting. Those countries pummeled worst by the pandemic will find themselves farther in the fiscal hole once the economic fallout begins in earnest. In an effort to fix outbreak and economy at the same time, we find the grim calculus of capital attempting to push the two crises of its own making onto the indigenous and the poorest workers worldwide. Brazil, under Bolsonaro, even before the Amazonian fire comes immediately to mind, but also in the US, the government is aiming to reduce the already criminal wages immigrant farm workers are making as a kind of pandemic relief for agricultural companies. Now, our series of cycles of accumulation, the US cashing out and China ramping up, impacted COVID's very origins. Over the past 40 years, China chose to engage in a massive shifts in land use and migration to domestically feed and pay its population. These shifts had considerable impact on decoupling and then recoupling traditional ecologies into these new configurations that had a profound effect on economy and epidemiology alike. So we see post-economic liberalization in China, the rise of multiple strains of new influenzas, including H5N1, H6N1, H7N9, H9N2, as well as SARS-1, and now an explosion in cases of African swine fever, which killed half of China's hog last year. Now, there's some controversy as to COVID's local origins, but the genetics of the virus, SARS-2, show it to be a recombinant of a bat coronavirus and a pangolin strain that subsequently went through some attuning to the human immune system, whether before that happened before the Wuhan outbreak or during it. But clearly, agriculture had a role to play in this process, even if that central Wuhan market didn't. Somehow, the virus got from one of the many coronaviruses documented to circulate among a variety of bat species in central China into Wuhan proper. To claim agriculture has no impact as China's moving toward as an official position, or absurdly, that the virus didn't originate in China at all, would position opponents of agriculture's role in a pretty precarious position. I mean, how do you explain the move from bats through pangolins through perhaps another intermediate species, such as hog, into humans without bringing up agriculture or logging or mining? As there's a Scripps Institute study shows that despite rumors, the genetics don't support a lab accident. Now, in all likelihood, in expanding regional circuit of production maneuvered both the increasingly formalized wild food sector and industrial livestock production further into China's hinterlands, where both sectors increasingly encountered bat reservoirs. And so these peri-urban loops are growing in extent and population, and they can increase the interface and spillover between wild non-human populations and newly urbanized rural areas. These new geographies also reduce the kind of environmental complexity with which these forests can disrupt the transmission of deadly viruses, as we would like our forests to do. They do work for us when we allow them to exist. Now, that regional circuit of production of COVID's likely origins, forest, peri-urban to city, is reproduced around the world. It's not just China. And it offers a broader framework by which to organize our thinking about outbreaks nearly everywhere. So we have SARS-1 and 2, Ebola, Zika, yellow fever, African swine fever, avian swine influenza, Nipah virus, Q fever, among others, and historically HIV, all originated or reemerged somewhere along such expanding circuits of production, whether in the forest or in the new peri-urban continuum or in factory farms or processing plants near or in cities. Many such new ecologies are driven by imperial or neoliberal imposition. They're not just emerging out of nowhere. So clearly, infectious diseases aren't merely matters of the virus itself, but also the context in which they emerge. Indeed, looking toward the future, we find that coronaviruses are only one of many pathogens developing in such an agroeconomic context. What we are suffering today is already in motion somewhere else, many times over. So these are like viral hurricanes lining up in the Atlantic Ocean, one after the other. So what to do? As perhaps a prompt for our conversation today, I'll touch upon some possibilities, if only as a series of rhetorical questions. Are we prepared to rebuild the town economies that permit farmers and fisher folk around the world the autonomy they need to source local inputs without destroying wilderness? Can we learn to learn from indigenous groups how to treat a landscape as much as a matter of our ethos as a source of food? Will we finally abandon settler ideologies? Will we reintroduce ourselves back into Earth's cycles of regeneration? Can we rediscover our sense of individuation, who we are, in multitudes of people beyond what state and capital offer us, like on this call? Are we prepared to fight to reclaim rural and forest landscapes in local waters that agribusiness has turned into sacrifice zones for global capital? Will we aim to defeat agribusiness as both a mode of production and a political opponent, from its lobbying in state capitals to its campaigns in killing environmental activists along neoliberal frontiers of the forest edge? And I believe these questions are the fires we must walk through in order to be able to introduce the now suddenly obvious strategies in pandemic prevention. Among them, we need to protect the forest complexity that keeps deadly pathogens from lining up livestock and human hosts for a straight shot onto the world's travel network. We need to reintroduce the livestock and crop diversities and reintegrate animal and crop farming at scales that keep pathogens from ramping up in deadliness. We must once again allow our food animals to reproduce on site, on farms, restarting the natural selection that allows immune evolution to track pathogens in real time. In short, many of the very practices the indigenous and smallholders of the world engage in the matter of course of their everyday cultivation. So the question is, can we scale these out specific to the needs of people in place around the world? Can we, as the Zapatistas have been paraphrased, can we make un mundo donde quepan muchos mundos, a world where there are many worlds? Thank you.
That was a presentation by Rob Wallace, the author of Big Farms Make Big Flu, and co-author of Neoliberal Ebola, Modeling Disease Emergence from Finance to Forest and Farm. The full webinar on global food inequality and COVID-19 is available at www.tni.org/webinars. It includes contributions by Moyad Bsharat of the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, which is a member organization of La Via Campesina in Palestine, Ari Kuniawati from the Indonesian feminist organization Solidaritas Perempuan, SP, which works with women in grassroots communities across the rural-urban spectrum, Sai Sam Kam of Meta Foundation in Myanmar, and Paul Gioa, a peasant farmer in Germany and member of the coordination committee of the European coordination La Via Campesina. Thank you for listening this far. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you'd like to find out more about TNI's work, please look us up at www.tni.org/supporters and find us on social media at TN Institute on Twitter and Transnational Institute on Instagram and Facebook. Make sure to sign up for our newsletter where we share our latest work and register for our upcoming webinars on www.tni.org.